Thank you. One of the stories that Steve told, Steve Thomas, last weekend was, I think it was in Algeria. He and two others were traveling there to a church. It's a Muslim country, but they were up in the Atlas Mountains and they were Berber tribesmen who had come to Christ. And I'll carry on while you fiddle with this. If I need to change mics, just tell me. But he said this church gathered, and there were three of them, and I think it was the Friday they first met, because Friday would be when the Muslim, traditionally would meet. And I think the leader of the church said to them, okay, well, there's three of you, and we've got 6 hours, so each of you can speak for 2 hours. And at the end of that meeting, I'm missing some of it, but it was, okay, we're going to meet on Saturday and Sunday. And it just carried on like that, just lots and lots of word. And I've got over a chapter to go through, so I'm going to race on. Today's title, I'm not going to go on for 2 hours. I don't want to, you don't want me to, no one wants me to, so this is good. We're all in agreement. But today's title is The Battle for Belief. When I was writing it down, I actually wrote down The Battle for Belize. But it isn't for Belize. That's a country in Central America. It's a battle for belief. But it is those little differences that can make such a big difference. Yesterday was a beautiful day. Judy and I, we went up to across to Ambleside. We enjoyed the sunshine, the flowers. We found a jacaranda tree. Who knows what a jacaranda tree? One or two of three or four of you, okay? They grow in South America. They grew in Zimbabwe. They are beautiful. They have purple flowers. In Zimbabwe, they'd come into flower in August. Here, that's springtime there. Here, it's just coming into flower, but I'm determined to get back in the next couple of days to get a photograph of it. They're spectacular. But to see this jacaranda tree and the ocean and the sun shining on the ocean and the birds song, and it was warm. It was lovely. As we drove home around midday, I noticed that Deep Cove wasn't such a nice place to be. It was cloudy. It looked like it was raining there. Certainly the valley to the east of Mount Seymour, there was rain hanging down, and we thought it was a jolly good job we went to Ambleside and not to Deep Cove. It was just a little decision. I had actually thought of taking Judy to Deep Cove, but no, we went to Ambleside. How different it could have been. The same day, just a few miles apart, but how different. And that's just geography. Inside ourselves, just a little difference can make a huge difference. How do we stay on track? How do we live victoriously? There's a good religious phrase. How do we live? What does living victoriously mean? To live believing, not just in our head, but fully in every aspect of our life. As Judy and I were talking and walking at Ambleside, we talked about what it must be like, the job of a company secretary with emails and real mail and phone messages and real people coming in and their job to somehow, whatever comes into the company needs to comply with the policy of the company. Instead of being thrown hither and thither, however you pronounce that word, by every email and every phone message and every person who comes in, how do we take what comes our way and rule and stay on track with what the company is about? How do we do this? How do we take what comes our way and make it submit to the kingdom life, to the King? How do we keep our belief believing? How do we keep our life living, our love loving, our compassion compassioning, our mercy mercying? How do we do these things? Well, we're going to look in quite a long passage. I'm going to read it all. Starting in Mark chapter 4, verse 35, going through all of Mark 5, and then the first 6 verses of chapter 6. Jesus is traveling with his new family. If you remember a few weeks back when we were looking in Mark chapter 3, at the end of Mark chapter 3, he turned, or people had said, look, your mother and your brothers and sisters are here. And he turned around and said, Jesus turned and said, behold, he pointed to those around him, behold, my mother and my brothers, for whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother. And in these chapters and in the ones intervening that we covered the last couple of weeks, Jesus is traveling with his new spiritual family, those who are seeking to do God's will. He counts those as his brothers, counts you and me as his brothers, sister, and mother. Let's read. And as we read, I'm going to make 6 points. I'm going to draw out 6 points afterwards. But they are all tied up with the responses to Jesus. So pay some attention to that, if you like, as we read. And on that day, when evening had come, Jesus said to them, his disciples, let us go to the other side of the lake, the Sea of Galilee. And leaving the multitude, they took him along with them, just as he was in the boat, and other boats were with him. And there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat, so much that the boat was already filling up. And he himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they awoke him and said to him, teacher, don't you care that we're perishing? And being aroused, he rebuked the wind and said to the sea, hush, be still. And the wind died down, and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, why are you so timid? How is it that you have no faith? And they became very much afraid and said to one another, who then is this, that even the wind and the sea obey him? And they came to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gerasenes, and when he had come out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him, and he had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. And constantly, night and day, among the tombs and in the mountains, he was crying out and gashing himself with stones. And seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and bowed down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he says, what do I have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God, do not torment me. For he, Jesus, had been saying to him, come out of the man, you unclean spirit. And he was asking him, what is your name? And he said to him, my name is Legion, for we are many. And he began to entreat him earnestly not to send them out of the country, them being the spirits. Now there was a big herd of swine, pigs, feeding there on the mountain. And the demons entreated him, saying, send us into the swine so that we may enter them. And he gave them permission, and coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them, and they were drowned in the sea. And their herdsmen ran away and reported it in the city and in the country, and the people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed sitting down, clothed and in his right mind, the very man who had had the legion, and they became frightened. And those who had seen it described to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man, and all about the swine. And they began to entreat him to depart from their region. And as he was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed was entreating him that he might accompany him. And he didn't let him, but he said to him, go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him. And everyone marveled. And when Jesus had crossed over again in the boat to the other side, a great multitude gathered about him, and he stayed by the seashore. And one of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up, and upon seeing him, fell at his feet and entreated him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Please come and lay your hands on her that she may get well and live, that she may be saved and live." And he went off with him, and a great multitude was following him and pressing in on him. And a woman who had had a hemorrhage for 12 years and had endured much at the hands of many physicians and had spent all that she had and was not helped at all, but rather had grown worse, after hearing about Jesus, came up in the crowd behind him and touched his cloak. For she thought, "If I just touch his garments, I shall get well. I shall be saved." And immediately the flow of her blood was dried up, and she felt in her body that she was healed of her affliction. And immediately Jesus, perceiving in himself that the power proceeding from him had gone forth, turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my garments?" And his disciples said to him, "You see the multitude pressing in on you, and you say, 'Who touched me?'" And he looked around to see who had done this. And the woman, fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Your faith has saved you. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." While he was still speaking, they came from the house of the synagogue official, saying, "Your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher anymore?" But Jesus, overhearing what was being spoken, said to the synagogue official, "Do not be afraid. Only believe." And he allowed no one to follow with him except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. And they came to the house of the synagogue official, and he beheld a commotion and people loudly weeping and wailing. And entering in, he said to them, "Why make a commotion and weep? The child hasn't died, but is asleep." And they began laughing at him. But putting them all out, he took along the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child was. And taking the child by the hand, he said to her, "Talitha kum," which translated means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl rose and began to walk, for she was 12 years old. And immediately they were completely astounded. And he gave them strict orders that no one should know about this. And he said that something should be given to her to eat. And he went out from there. And he came into his hometown, his own country. And his disciples followed him. And when the Sabbath had come, he began to teach in the synagogue. And the many listeners were astonished, saying, "Where did this man get these things? And what is this wisdom given to him? And such miracles as these performed by his hands? Isn't this the carpenter, son of Mary and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us?" And they took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his own relatives and in his own household." And he could do no miracles there except that he laid his hands upon a few sick people and healed them. And he wondered at their unbelief. And he was going around the villages teaching. Father, I thank you for your word that you spoke probably through Peter to Mark.
And Mark wrote these things down. And hundreds of years later, we read of you, Lord Jesus, and your disciples. We read of you, and fellow Jews. We read of you amongst the Gentiles. Lord, open our hearts and plant your word in us. Cause it to bear fruit. Open our ears to hear and our eyes to see. And Lord, help us to believe. Free us from our unbelief. Lord, do all this by the power of your Holy Spirit, I ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, there's lots in there. I want to, hopefully quite swiftly, move through 6 points. There are many, many, many more than 6 points here. But there are 6 points that I felt that God wanted me to highlight. And the first is this. Jesus said, "Let us go over to the other side." It was Jesus who spoke to the disciples and said, "Let us go over to the other side." It was as Jesus obeyed. Sorry. It was as, well, I suppose Jesus probably obeyed his father, didn't he? Because he only did what he saw his father doing, only said what his father, he heard his father speaking. But he obeyed the father in saying this, but then the disciples obeyed Jesus. And it was in obeying that this fierce storm arose. Isn't that what we experience? It isn't just when we hear God and say, "God is saying this, well, I'm going to do that." It isn't only then that troubles come in our lives. But as we follow Jesus, troubles, fierce storms arise in our lives. Jesus, toward the end of his ministry with his disciples in John chapter 16, verse 33, he said to his disciples, and they'd already learned that this was the truth, but he said to them, "In the world, you will have tribulation. You will have trouble. But take courage. I have overcome the world." Trouble is the context of our faith. If it weren't, we would just be fair-weather fans. We would be cheering on the Canucks if they were 3-1 up in the series. We would not be walking out. We would not be turning off the television. But we would be saying, "This is my team, for better or for worse. And this is one of those worst times. This is my team." Growing up as a boy, got to throw this one in. Derek, you're right. I'm going to throw this out. Growing up as a boy, my father was born in Leeds in North England, and he supported a soccer team, Leeds United. I had an older brother. I still have an older brother, 4 years older. He supported Leeds United. I was part of the Whitley family. I supported Leeds United, except sibling rivalry kicked in, and my brother would not let me support Leeds United to the point of almost bloodshed. Certainly to the point of hurt. So I chose to support Chelsea. And this afternoon in England, Chelsea beat, who was it they beat? They beat Wigan 7-0, and they are champions of the Premiership. Okay. I wonder if I would just be a fair weather friend, a fair weather fan, if they had lost. But if all we experienced following God was goodness, well, of course we'd follow him, wouldn't we? We might not love him. We might not worship him, but we'd certainly pin our following to him because it would be better for us. These storms test us. They test our joining to him. And they don't just test in the way of we can get a mark at the end of it, but they test us in the way that at the end of it we can say, "You know what? I was faithful through that. Wow, this is good. God is real in me. I am so glad I'm in God because God has done something. It tests and proves us. It encourages us as we go through these storms and troubles. As long as it doesn't kill us. And even if it kills us, he is the one who leads us on paths of righteousness for his name's sake. And he is the one amongst those paths of righteousness. He is the one who leads us in the valley of death's dark shade. And he is the only one who can lead us through the veil. I have not ever sat with someone as they died. You have sat with someone. Did you go with them beyond the veil? No, you didn't, David. And there are others of you here who have sat with someone as they went through the veil. But you couldn't go. But Jesus goes with us, meets us on the other side, and suddenly we see him, I believe, with eyes wide open as he truly is. I look around. If I was quick with numbers, I'd think there are 183 people here. I don't know how many there are of us here. But I know this, there is not one exception here who is not experiencing trouble in their lives today. Not one of you. And it may be very personal trouble, or it may be the trouble that your neighbor is in, or your daughter, or your father, or your business. But I know there. Anyone here? Just to prove me wrong, give you a chance. Anyone here, no trouble in their lives? Not a one. Was there one? Bob. Okay, let me give you some trouble. Come on. I know you're joking. Because you were nodding your head earlier. You're giving me trouble. Thanks. Okay. The context of our faith is trouble. And it is in the context of following Jesus. You follow hard after Jesus, you will follow hard into trouble. It is the truth. And if you steer away from Jesus, you will still steer into trouble. Far better to have Jesus with us as we go into it than have him far away. That was point one. Pretty swift. Good. Okay, now we're going to go into how we, or responses, in amongst these troubles, how do we respond? Verse 8. I don't know the tone of voice. I try and hear it. I don't think it was, teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? I mean, they're in a storm, for goodness sake. They really do believe that the boat could sink. You ever been on a boat close to sinking? Arnold's nodding his head a little bit. You have definitely, Mike and Kim and their family, Mark up there, you've been in a boat that capsized. And you didn't know it was going to happen until it was. I don't think you speak saying, teacher, do you not care that we are perishing? I never speak like that, do I, honey? No. I don't know how it would be. I really don't. I mean, we know that this is Jesus. So we, you know, at a point of calm like this, standing up here, we know that we've got to speak respectfully. But many of us here, and I count myself included, know that when push comes to shove and it's in a really dark, troublesome place, we do not always speak to God respectfully. It comes out the way it really is. Teacher, don't you care? We're perishing! Something more like that to be heard above the crash of the waves and the storm. Something more like that. An accusation. It's not really a question, is it? It's not really, I really want to know, do you care that we're perishing? It's really the accusation, except it's just nicely turned around so it's got a semblance of respect. But it's really, you don't care that we're perishing. That's what it's really saying. We've all experienced that. When Judy says to me, have you put out the rubbish? She isn't asking, have I put out the rubbish? She's telling me that I haven't put out the rubbish. Actually, that's directed to Jordan these days. But we understand, we term it as a question, but it isn't really a question at all. It's an accusation. So easily, we find ourselves accusing Jesus in the middle of the storm. Judy and I have experienced some storms between us. And I would like to say some good stuff about me at this point, but I'll be honest. I've discovered, I reckon I'm batting about 90%. This is like badly batting. The 10% is better than the 90%. But I have found when Judy, I'm picking on her because she can get me back later, when Judy sort of jabs me with one of those accusing questions, about 90% of the time, I jab her back with a bit of defense, a bit of self-justification, or attack is a good form of defense, a bit of kind of pointing out what she hasn't done. And it goes from bad to worse. I bat about 90%, but I recognize I do it, and I think I'm getting a bit better. And Jude is graciously smiling at me. I am getting a little better. But if it was me in the boat, and they said to me, don't you care, I'd have been turning right back on them saying, well, and I'd be pointing out all the things that they're doing wrong and all this sort of stuff. But Jesus isn't like that. And we've experienced this, haven't we, when we accuse him, hush, be still. He calms the storm. And he does provoke us to a better kind of faith. Why are you so timid? How is it that you have no faith? There's no reply. How do you answer a question like that? That's the sort of thing that you go away and think, faith, we are drowning. But he expected faith. 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 Timid. I was out there in the... Timid. How was I timid? How could he... I was in the storm. You go away and you think about it. And you tussle it through. And maybe next time you handle it a little bit better by the grace of God. But Jesus can handle our accusations. He handles them very well, though he may have something in addition to say to us. Number 3, observation. Chapter 5, the first 20 verses. A remarkable deliverance, but not something totally new to them. Back in chapter 1, verses 14 to 20, Jesus is traveling in the same region and he gathers to himself Simon and Andrew, two fishermen, and they're amongst his disciples now. He gathers to himself James and John, two more fishermen. And later on in that chapter, they go into a synagogue on the Sabbath, and in verses 21 to 28, there is an account of a man in the synagogue being delivered of an unclean spirit. And that unclean spirit spoke to Jesus. What do we have to do with you, Jesus of Nazareth? And here, on the other side of the lake, in verse 7, this man with unclean spirit says, what do I have to do with you, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? In this passage, in these 20 verses, 1 to 20 in chapter 5, the only reference to the disciples is, in my version, the second word in the passage. And they came to the other side of the sea. Jesus and his disciples got to the other side. If you read through those next 20 verses, you will not find another reference to them. Next reference to them. It's quite a ways later on. It's not even right at the beginning of meeting with Jairus. The disciples are there. But I think quite wisely, they're keeping their mouths shut and just observing. And there is a place for that as we learn from our God. What do they observe? I don't know, because it's not recorded. It's not written here what they saw and what they kind of registered in their thinking. But I imagine that they realized that there wasn't an awful lot of difference between Jew and Gentile. There wasn't a lot of difference between the Jew in the synagogue back in Capernaum and this Gentile man out in the tombs, in the cemetery, unclean, living amongst unclean people. There's not an awful lot of difference between them and us. They observe, definitely, Jesus with authority and compassion to deliver. And if we read further in chapter 6, not where we finished, but the next couple of verses, we would see that Jesus soon after starts sending out his disciples in pairs with authority over unclean spirits. And they went out preaching the good news, healing the sick, and in verse 13 of chapter 6, casting out many demons. Somewhere in this, and we're not given all the details, but somewhere in this, they observe Jesus delivering. And somewhere, as authority is imparted to them when they're sent out, they know what to do, and they know how to do it. And many of us, in one way or another, have experienced something like that. Steering away from walking with Jesus, I was a policeman for 6 years in the UK. And people have often said to me, so what did you learn as a policeman? And the bottom line, the one thing that I know that I learned as a policeman was how to deal with things that I had absolutely no idea how to deal with. Time and again, you'd arrive at a scene, as they say in the movies and all this stuff, you'd arrive at a scene and it'd be like, oh, here's a policeman, he'll know what to do. And I would think, whoa, here's a scene and I wonder what we do here. I remember my very first, what they call an unexpected death. So this is a death where it's unexpected, speaks for itself, doesn't it? It's an unexpected death. This particular death was of a fairly elderly man who was mowing his lawn, and his wife called out the window and didn't get a reply and found him dead outside. And an unexpected death, because there isn't a doctor in attendance, all that sort of thing, police have to attend until someone says why it was he died and all this sort of thing. And I had never dealt with one of these. This was fresh out of training. It was fresh out of being with a more experienced officer. I was on my own. I had no idea exactly what I needed to do, but I knew that this widow really wanted to know that I had it under control. Thanks be to God, she was from a military background, and she was a good officer's wife, and fairly soon on she said, would you like a cup of tea? I said, I'd love a cup of tea. So she went through to the kitchen to make a cup of tea, and I said, would you mind if I used your phone? She said, of course. Close the door. Sarge, my sergeant, what do I do? Somewhere, the disciples learnt that what they need to do is ask God what to do. We're not told all of that, but they learnt something of seeing what Jesus did and they learned something of how he was led by the Spirit of God. So that's what they did when they were sent out. They observed. And I guess for us, we need to pay attention, because one day we might be asked to do something we were expected to have observed and learnt from. Number four, bold faith. Jairus, the synagogue ruler. He knew that the Pharisees and the scribes had already made their mind up against Jesus, if you read earlier on in the book of Mark. And he was a synagogue ruler. He rubbed shoulders with Pharisees and scribes. But somewhere he was in a predicament, and he thought it through, and we're not given all that he thought through, but he had to face the fact that if he goes to Jesus, he is going to face trouble with the Pharisees and scribes, but something far greater, of course, is happening, isn't it? His 12-year-old daughter is at the point of death. But somewhere Jairus meant business. He assessed the alternatives. He knew what Jesus was like. He knew what Jesus could do. He knew what the Pharisees would like. And he knew what they could do. But somewhere he decided, and against all kind of natural leading, he decided to leave his very sick daughter, which would be the place he would most want to be, and to go to God. It's the big test. Did he stay with his little girl, or did he go to God? And it's a test that we have to face in many circumstances. Do we stay in our trouble, or do we leave our trouble and go to God? And here, Jairus left his trouble. It's hardly right to call his daughter his trouble, but he left and he went to God. Now, we don't have the opportunity to physically go to Jesus. He isn't walking around here. But there is something that we have to do in our troubles, which is about ceasing to nurse them, no matter how good it would be to nurse our little girl. We need to cease nursing our trouble and go to God. Bold faith. My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her that she may be saved and live. And when discouragement comes when we step boldly out like this, Jesus is swift to encourage. When the news came about the fact that the daughter was dead, as he overheard the messenger, he turned quickly, before anything else could be said, he turned quickly and said to Jairus, "Don't be afraid. Only keep on believing." And many of us, I know I have many of you here as well, have heard in the times of trouble, as you've set yourself to go the right way, and as another fresh wave comes over the boat to go back to a different story, as another bout of convulsion hits our daughter, the Lord saying, "Don't be afraid. Keep believing. Don't be afraid. Keep on believing." There's a challenge here as well, because every person that came to Jesus that's recorded in the Gospels, every person who came to Jesus was healed or was delivered. In Mark chapter 9, verses 14 to 29, I won't turn there, but it's after Jesus comes down from the Mount of Transfiguration. And he comes upon a scene where there is a man with his epileptic son, probably epilepsy. And he's been to the disciples. He's been to people like you and me. Not to Jesus, but to people like you and me. And his son is still in the grip of epilepsy. And Jesus is there, and he turns to Jesus and says, "I told your disciples to cast it out, and they could not do it." Jesus did it, but his disciples didn't do it. Jesus later went on and said, this kind, as is, because the disciples came to him, said, "Why couldn't we do it? You could, but why couldn't we?" And he said to them, "This kind cannot come out by anything but prayer." In later manuscripts and in some of your translations, it will say this kind that Jesus said, "This kind cannot come out by anything but prayer with fasting." They had prayed there and then. But the prayer that Jesus is talking about is the prayer that goes on beforehand. And somehow, somewhere, it's clear from the scriptures that Jesus lived, he would say, I'm sure, he lived a life of prayer. I might be tempted to say that he lived a life of sufficient prayer. He prayed enough. He prayed more than I do. Because sometimes I've prayed for our children and others, and they've been healed. And sometimes they haven't. I know if it were Jesus, it would. The only thing that we see later on in the passages we've read, the only thing that stopped Jesus healing was a lack of faith. He was fully prepared. But his disciples were not always fully prepared. And I, to my shame, am not fully prepared all the time. What's the solution to that? Well, not in Mark's gospel, but in Luke's gospel, chapter 11, verses 5 to 13, besides anything else, Jesus, speaking to his disciples, says this: "Ask and keep asking, and it shall be given to you. Seek, keep seeking, and you shall find. Knock, keep knocking, and it shall be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. Everyone who seeks finds. And to him who knocks, it shall be open." Persistence is required. There are certain skills in life that I have learned. There are certain other skills in life that I have not learned. The ones that I have learned are the ones that I did enough to learn. The ones that I haven't learned are the ones that I stopped short and didn't learn. It's as simple as that. I wish it were otherwise. But it is as simple as that. I learned to ride a bike. I learned to change gear in a standard car. All sorts of things. But there are plenty of things I haven't learned. I haven't learned how to skate well. Beyond kind of just trying to stand up. That's about as good as I get skating. I know I could learn. But can I be bothered to learn? Persistence tests us. But Jesus encourages bold faith. Point number 5, faith with fear. If I just touch his garments, I shall be saved. Unclean for 12 years, depleted iron reserves, always tired for 12 years. No father comes on her behalf. No husband battles through the crowds, alone in her uncleanness. Too tired, too full of shame to boldly kneel before him and entreat him. For who? For just her ragged self. But if I just touch his garments, I shall be saved. And Jesus, who knew Nathanael under the fig tree, who knew the Samaritan woman at Jacob's well, did not know who touched him. Why? Because he only saw what the Father showed him. his Father, gracious, compassionate, merciful Lord, who had a greater plan. Father could have let it go, never even spoken to Jesus that something had happened. Father could have just let the woman go her way, healed, but not fully, healed in body, but not in spirit. The woman could have gone her way and fulfilled the law and what it demanded, and eventually be declared clean. But she would never know if God really knew. But instead, the Father says to Jesus, something. Who touched you? Power has gone out of you. And Jesus says to the crowd, who touched me? I don't think he was laughing like I just laughed. Who touched me? Maybe he knew. There are times when I would say to my children, who did that? And I knew exactly who had already done it. I was just giving them an opportunity to say, so that we could handle it that way. There were times when I said, who did that? And I knew exactly who it was, but I was wrong. David delights to tell a story, and actually the other children as well, delights to tell a story where he got into trouble, and he shouldn't have. Did Jesus know who it was? Who touched me? Why is he asking? Well, it's because Jesus is the one that Psalm 3, verse 3 is written about. But thou, O Lord, art a shield about me, my glory, and the one who lifts my head. To come and be acknowledged by Jesus. To hear him say, daughter, who already came out earlier this meeting, I can't remember who it was now. But to hear Jesus say, daughter, I think it was you, Arnold, wasn't it? Yeah. Relationship reestablished. To hear your faith has saved you. She had lived a wretched life for at least 12 years. To be commended for her faith. Your faith. My faith? Me? I'm just a ragged lady. My faith? Go in peace. Be healed of your afflictions. And what a treasure for the rest of her life. I can hear her saying later on, and you know what he said to me? He said to me, daughter, your faith. He said it to me. Jesus, the one who lifts our head. Not just satisfied with a physical healing, but one who sends her on her way, dancing and happy. I don't care. I'm clean. I once was unclean, I'm clean. Jesus meets those who come to him with faith and fear. And finally, offense, number 6. Isn't this the carpenter, the son of Mary? Most times in Scripture, it's like James and John, the son of Zebedee, their father. Why don't they say, isn't this Jesus, the carpenter, son of Joseph? Well, no. They're saying, this is Jesus, the carpenter, the illegitimate, the one who doesn't have a dad. Just a carpenter. Their offense primarily is not to do with him, but it's to do with the one who sent him, when we just had 3 or 4 children, I can't remember, we used to send Zoe out. She was 4 or 5 years old. We would send Zoe into the garden to say, go and get the boys in. And she would go into the garden and say, it's time to come in. And would they come in? No, they jolly well wouldn't. They'd carry on playing. Why? Because they just think, Zoe's just one of us. She's just my older sister who I can beat up. She's just my older sister who's a pain in the neck. She's just my older sister. She's just like me. I'm not going to do what she says. We learnt to take the burden off of Zoe. We learnt to say to Zoe, go out there and say, Mum and Dad say it's time to come in. She was just the messenger then. And then they had to face who the message really came from. But Jesus came in, and they took offense at him. What gives you the right to speak to us the way you did? What gives you the right to speak with authority? How are you any different to us? Well, today, of course, we don't face Jesus. He's not standing up here in front of you. But we face each other, fellow disciples. What offends us with one another? Because it is still Jesus, the body of Christ. Are we offended with how Dave led communion this morning? Are we offended because he's American? Are we offended because I'm British? Too young, untrained. Too young, too old. Too casual, too smart, too rough, too smooth, too long, too short. Go to Jesus. Get help. Because somehow faith, when we're offended, is short-circuited. And it can be by something so tiny, so trivial. When we come to God, who is God and loves us. As Judy and I walked and talked along Ambleside yesterday, we got to a point where we knew it would be good for us to pray, and we listed what we needed to pray. We needed to pray forgiveness, and we needed to pray blessing, and we needed to pray thankfulness. And as we stopped to pray, it was jolly difficult. And then I said, you know what, honey, I think we need to change that round, don't we? We need to start off with gratitude. And then pray a blessing. And then we'll find it's quite easy to forgive. And that's how it worked, didn't it? Jesus' family were offended with him. But you know what? Mary was there at the cross. Mary and his brothers were there in the upper room. Pentecost. They got through it. How did they get through it? They got through it because they stuck with him. They didn't like him. They're pretty offended with him some of the time. But they stuck with him. And Jesus is well able to bring each one of his new family home. James even led the church in Jerusalem. As we travel with him, we experience such good news because we're his family. As we travel with him, as we look to do his will, he will build our faith. He will be with us and see us through the storms and troubles. He will show us and persuade us of his authority. We will see grace and compassion, encouragement and mercy, deliverance and healing, and provocation to good faith. And we will have words to treasure. Daughter, son, your faith has saved you. go in peace. Be healed of your afflictions.